All right, well, thanks everyone for coming. I'm Eli Hassenfeld. I'm one of GiveWell's co-founders. This is Natalie Crispin.
Hi, I'm a senior research analyst at GiveWell.
And so we're really happy that you joined us tonight. I just want to quickly go through some of the logistics and the basic plan for the evening, and then I'll turn it over to Natalie to talk a little bit. Just first, like we do with pretty much everything that GiveWell does, we're going to try to share as much of this evening as we can with our audience. And so that means that we're going to record the audio of this session and publish a transcript on our website. If you say anything that you would prefer not be included in the audio or the transcript, just email me, Eli@givewell.org, or info@givewell.org, or just come find me at the end of the night, and we can make sure to cut that from the event. You should feel free to speak totally freely this evening, and we can deal with the transparency part afterwards. So the basic plan is that the first thing we're going to talk about is GiveWell's top charities. It's December, and we just refreshed our recommendations. And so Natalie's going to go through the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities and some of the major changes over the past year. Then we're going to take a little break for questions, and we're going to break periodically throughout the evening to give you a chance to ask whatever's on your mind. And generally speaking, I would encourage you to just ask whatever. Don't try to make sure that you're only asking something that we have not written about. One of the main reasons that we do events like this is that we want to enable people to ask questions that they might not have had a chance to find the answers to on our website. And so we really hope you'll take this chance to ask about whatever's on your mind regarding our work. So regardless, Natalie's going to start talking about the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities. We'll break for questions. I'll then talk a little bit about the future of GiveWell's research and some of the growth that we've had over the last few years. Then we'll take a brief intermission so people can get some more food. And then we'll come back and talk about the Open Philanthropy Project, which is another part of our research. First, I'll give a high-level overview of that project. And then Chloe Coburn, who is our program officer for criminal justice reform, she's over there. She'll go into the more detail on her work and her efforts in that area. So without further ado, Natalie, why don't you kick it off?
Great. So thanks everyone for coming. Really great to have this many people to talk about our work with. I've been at GiveWell for 6 years, and I work on our top charity recommendations. So both following organizations that we have recommended in the past and finding new organizations to potentially add to that list. So I'll give a brief summary of what has happened this year, top charities, strengths and weaknesses, and try to just give some basics so that then you can ask questions and let me know what you are interested in knowing more about. So first, the process for finding our top charities. In very brief, it starts with an assessment of the academic literature, and that focuses on the program level, so vaccinations or deworming or bed nets to protect against malaria. And we do that because in our experience, charities don't have the type of information that would lead us to be able to establish the cause and effect of a program. The type of information that we often rely on are randomized controlled trials. It's not the only evidence we look at, but it does form a big part of those assessments. We then use that information to look for organizations that are running programs that we've identified as particularly cost-effective and are implementing those programs well. So in 2015, we largely looked for organizations that were working on priority programs. And that full list is on our website, but it generally includes global health and nutrition organizations, as well as unconditional and conditional cash transfers. Other examples are micronutrient programs, vaccinations, and then the programs that our top charities are running, bed nets and deworming. So overall, you may have seen that our top charities are the same four as they were in 2014. Their strengths and weaknesses, really briefly. There's AMF and Deworm the World Initiative, and we think both of those are very high quality organizations. So AMF, sorry, Against Malaria Foundation, they are running bed net distribution programs to protect against malaria and save children's lives. The Deworm the World Initiative provides assistance to deworming programs to deliver pills to heal intestinal parasites. So those two organizations are running very cost-effective programs. We think they're high-quality organizations. The Against Malaria Foundation, in the past, we had a major concern with them that they were not moving money out the door and delivering bed nets as quickly as we might have expected, and it had a limited track record of working with partners to carry out very large scale distributions compared to what they had done in the past. And in 2015, we saw an improvement in that track record. So they went from working with one partner in Malawi to working with two partners, one also in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So it's still a fairly limited track record, but a big step for them. And they were able to collect the monitoring data that they aimed to. There were three major updates on Deworm the World Initiative. One was that they worked with the Indian government to establish a national deworming day. So before that, individual states might carry out deworming, but there wasn't a national push for it. We are not confident that they played a key role in that, but think there's a possibility that they did, and if they did, helped expand a program to millions of more children. They also improved the quality of the monitoring that they collected and shared with us so that we have higher confidence in that deworming treatments are getting to the children that they aim to get to, and the quality of the program is generally high. They also have significantly more room for more funding this year. They had several opportunities to expand to new countries, and we think that they will continue to have those opportunities. The third organization is GiveDirectly. They fund unconditional cash transfers to households in Uganda and Kenya. And they are a very high quality organization that does a somewhat less cost-effective program. So we think AMF and Deworm the World are higher cost-effective programs, but we think GiveDirectly is a really high quality organization, and there's a very strong link between what they do and impact on the ground. Overall, we think that their operations continued to be very high quality and were expanding in both countries that they were working in. They also put additional effort into networking with potential partners, and one such partnership led to a program that's going to start next year with a bilateral aid donor and funding from Google in order to test cash transfers against a more traditional aid program and see which is more effective. The last top charity is the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative. They, like Deworm the World, fund deworming programs. We think it's a very cost-effective program. We've had in past years and have continued to have some communication challenges with them, and generally have not been able to have a concrete sense of how they have spent funds and what funding they hold, and that continues to be the case. The other major update with them is that they did provide additional monitoring that we thought somewhat increased the case for their impact. We also continue to designate four standout organizations, and those are the same this year as they were in previous years. The Iodine Global Network and Living Goods, there are no real major updates there. We did continue to speak with them. There were some significant updates on Development Media International and GAIN. So Development Media International produces radio and television programming to encourage people in the developing world to change their health behaviors and with the aim of saving children's lives. They had, in last year we had reviewed the midline results of their trial to test how effective their program is. And those results showed increases in the behaviors they were targeting, in some of the behaviors they were targeting. They then came out with endline results this year that they shared with us, and those results were not as positive. They did not show changes in the behaviors, and they did not find a decrease in childhood mortality, which was the aim of the program. There's also the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, and the program we looked at with them was the Universal Salt Iodization Program. They work with governments to try to increase the access to iodized salt. And we spent significantly more time in 2015 trying to understand their programs. We spoke with their staff in India, as well as sent two staff members to Ethiopia to learn more about the program there. We ultimately found that we were not able to establish a clear case for impact for their program, and we attribute this to difficulty in connecting their activities with the impact that they aim to achieve, as well as communication trouble, difficulties that we've had with them. So those are the four standouts. In terms of what's changed overall with our top charity recommendations, there, we believe, is a stronger case for our top charities this year than there was last year. We think that the organizations have a longer track record, just an extra year of us following them and them operating, and those track records have generally shown success at operating their programs. We've also seen some cases where there's been more and improved monitoring, particularly with the Deworm the World initiative. And then there's also significantly room for more funding across the board. Each of our top charities have more opportunities to spend funds productively, we believe. And commensurate with both of those considerations, we've recommended more funding from Good Ventures, the foundation that we work closely with, which was started by Dustin Moskovitz, the co-founder of Facebook and Asana, and his wife, Carrie Tuna. So together with recommendations from earlier this year, they're giving $44 million to our top charities. We also think that the amount from individuals is likely to grow this year, and we're projecting about double over last year. So all around, significantly more money moved to our top charities. Because of both of these things, both more ability for the charities to absorb money productively and more money going to them, we've spent significantly more time and thought into this concept of room for more funding and how to rank relative opportunities against each other. So thinking more about what constitutes a particularly promising funding gap that we want filled, and ranking those funding gaps against each other. We've written a bunch about this on our blog, so I won't go into details right now, but please feel free to ask questions, and if there's particular aspects that you'd like to know more about, I'm happy to talk about that. So let me pause there. I've thrown a bunch of brief updates at you, and interested to know what you guys want to hear more about, so please do ask.
Speak a little more to how you really know for sure that because I think you're probably very thorough on that. Tell us a little more about how you go about confirming that what they're reporting is really happening, and how you can know that they're more effective at similar organizations doing similar work.
Sure. So for each of our top charities, we looked in depth at the monitoring information that they've shared. So they each do it in a different way. And we don't just take them at their word for what they say they have available. We look at the data ourselves and try to find discrepancies and ways that to try to understand the methodology really thoroughly of what they've done. So for example, the Against Malaria Foundation does post-distribution surveys, 6 months, 12 months, every 6 months for 2 years or so afterwards, they do these surveys where they go house to house and check whether bed nets are in place and being used on a regular basis. So we've looked at the results of those, as well as the reports on how they carry those out. And each of our top charities have processes like that to not just assume that the program has worked, but to really check that it's happening as planned.
Just to add like a little bit to what Natalie said, it's definitely possible that a charity is sending us like fraudulent materials, and we do not have a process for like right now for auditing those materials to determine if they're trying to defraud us. I would say a lot of our goal at this point has been force charities to move from the standard like tell a story and get a donor excited to the point where they would have to be like actively producing fraudulent materials in order to get a GiveWell recommendation for them to like convince us that we should support them. And it's interesting because this is something that I think was like a really good answer to this question like 4 or 5 years ago when the amount of money we were directing was like less than $1 million. And I think it becomes like less of a good answer as the money we direct grows and the incentives to potentially do this increase as well. And so one of the things that we've been talking about as we plan for future years or in, you know, for 2016 is whether we should be trying to do more to, given the amounts of money that we are influencing, to try and look for even, you know, bigger problem, look for like potential fraud among charities or potential top charities. I mean, frankly, given how closely we work, we know these organizations, I find it like very hard to imagine that this is happening. But nonetheless, like I think it's like a reasonable thing for us to do. And then the other part of your question, or I should add one thing. I mean, one small thing we've done is we've hired a journalist to go and like visit a couple of our top charities. And so this journalist, Jacob Kushner, went to Kenya to visit both GiveDirectly and Deworm the World and just like see whether anything looked really problematic. And he ended up reporting things that the charities both took to be pretty negative, but we took to be pretty positive, because what he reported was, and you can read about this on our blog, you know, if you Google like Jacob Kushner GiveWell, you'll find the blog posts. But you know, he reported some degree of displeasure in the villages that GiveDirectly had given money to among people who hadn't received the money, or parents of children who were dewormed in deworming programs in schools, that they didn't feel fully aware of exactly what the program was. And I mean, I think these are legitimate issues that we have written about on our website, but they are far from the concern that like the program wasn't having the effect that we hoped at all. And so that's about the fraud. And then the second question is like, how do we know that the Against Malaria Foundation, which distributes bed nets, is better than Nothing But Nets, like a very well-known organization that funds bed net distributions? And there, I mean, the true answer is we don't know. I mean, we don't have any information that tells us that Nothing But Nets is doing a bad job. What we know is that the Against Malaria Foundation is able to share significantly more information showing that its programs are successful than we've been able to get from Nothing But Nets. I think that groups that are willing to share, maybe people have different intuitions, but I put some weight on that like desire to be transparent as an indication of a better run program. And in the case of Nothing But Nets, you know, they've declined to participate in our process for a couple of years. And that definitely does not mean that I think their programs are failing. But, you know, if I had to bet like which one seems like a better use of funds, like I would give to the group that's sharing information and demonstrating its impact.
For a small nonprofit called the End Poverty Campaign, and what we propose is a comprehensive aid program where we'd like to see the U.S. government expand the Peace Corps and send representatives into individual villages or regions and organize the local people to monitor their own aid. Is that an idea that your organization would be, especially when you have access to potentially really major donors, with a way to, I really appreciate your honesty in what you already said, and it sounds like you've made some good steps forward. But perhaps you might consider this to be a further step forward, is having, you know, representatives from your organization or working with the Peace Corps go into the local communities and organize the local people so that you have a direct link and you bypass all the bureaucracy and the potentials for corruption and siphoning off the resources. Is that clear what I'm describing?
Yeah, I mean, so the you know, one of the key criteria that we rely on is this criterion of evidence of effectiveness. You know, is there evidence that this program has significant impact relative to other opportunities? And so, you know, what we, you know, with something like malaria nets, there are more than 20 randomized controlled trials that show that if you give out nets, people use them and they save lives. And so we would then say about this program, you know, does that type of evidence exist? And, you know, almost certainly it does not. And, you know, and we know, just to be clear, that, you know, when you have a criterion of evidence of effectiveness, there are things that are hard to measure and you potentially leave really great opportunities on the table. And, you know, GiveWell is trying to be a product for donors that has that meets the criteria that an outside observer can like understand what we're doing, can vet it themselves, and be confident that the donations are effective. even if that means sometimes leaving really great opportunities on the table. The other part of our research, the Open Philanthropy Project, is that we'll talk about more later, is the area where we're looking for more of those higher risk and potentially higher reward opportunities.
You mentioned that you often start with the academic sources to determine cause and effect. I was wondering if that's like skimming journals or looking at university websites or your personal contacts or what?
So we use different methods, but I'd say the most common thing is to use published studies and, if possible, meta-analyses that combine published studies in a highly rigorous way. And then we also reach out to experts when we have questions that can't be answered by that type of research. And yeah, I think those are the main tools that we use.
So I found it interesting that you guys pretty much stuck with the same charities this year for both the recommended and for the stand-up. And I was wondering if you saw any change in the behavior of other charities in your relationship towards them that didn't get them into either of those groups, but do you see any more trends? Do you see a trend of charities being more open to give well and trying to provide more evidence, or is it really mainly just kind of through the situation?
So we reached out to several additional organizations this past year and got to sort of an intermediate stage with them, but didn't progress fully to be able to make a top charity recommendation. And I would say that some of those groups are potentially ones that would not have been interested earlier in our history. It's hard to know. And we don't, while we have an open door policy of any organization can apply, we try to make our criteria and as transparent as possible. And so I think we don't get a large number of applications to that process because it's a fairly stringent set of criteria. So it's hard to know sort of what the trends are in terms of transparency.
Yeah, I would say that like as a general rule, as the amount of money that we are directing has grown, groups have been more willing to engage in our process. So in early years, like we would call up charities and they wouldn't want to talk to us because the incentive that they had was very low, and now the incentive is much greater. And so I think like one fundamental shift is that if there is a charity that we would really like to evaluate, by and large, they will spend time talking to us. Nothing But Nets is certainly an outlier in the respect that they have chosen not to. And so that's been a pretty big shift. It like Natalie said, it's harder to say that. I mean, I don't think we have had any noticeable effect on the sector as a whole.
So do you mean the they are, so if an organization has strong evidence of effectiveness, what their stated goals are doesn't matter. I think in practice, the organizations that we have been able to evaluate and establish a strong case for the evidence of effectiveness are fairly direct programs.
Saving lives,
improving lives, but more so that just the number of steps between their activities and the ultimate outcome is somewhat shorter than, say, an advocacy organization. It just is more difficult to evaluate that type of organization. That said, we've moved over time to be able to take into account more complicated causal chains, and so at first, we were just looking at, we were largely focused on organizations that they deliver products that save lives or improve lives. The Deworm the World Initiative works with governments to deliver deworming programs. They do not directly carry out the programs or, in many cases, buy the supplies. So there's definitely a longer case in that chain and less direct impact, and yet we think they are an outstanding organization and one of our top charities. The iodine charities that are on our standout list also are either advocacy or technical assistance organizations. So I think it's more difficult and there's often less evidence for that, but our processes have improved over time and are more able to take that into account than they were in the past. It's definitely something we still struggle with and are trying to learn how to do.
Another way of answering your question maybe is, like, on some level, the goal is independent of our research process in that, like, we often say we're cause agnostic, meaning whatever activity you're trying to implement, we are willing to consider it. At the same time, our goal is to identify the small set of groups that we're going to recommend to donors, and that definitely takes into account our judgment about the overall impact of achieving that goal. And so if a charity can demonstrate high effectiveness at doing something that seems less impactful to us, that will end up harming that organization in our research process.
Right.
And so just to put this like very concretely, I mean, we don't only care about saving lives. You know, it's saving lives, also improving lives. But right now, GiveDirectly, this group that tries to give 90% of the money they receive directly to very poor people, we think they are the most effective organization that we've ever seen at doing what they set out to, which is getting money into the hands of very poor people. But as a staff, collectively, we would guess that BedNets are 10 times as cost effective per dollar donated as getting cash into the hands of very poor people. And so therefore, we end up ranking the BedNet organization higher than GiveDirectly because of that overall impact. Just to be clear, I mean, we know that these cost effectiveness estimates are very thorny and, you know, rely on a lot of difficult assumptions, including this like kind of impossible like to judge philosophical judgment about how to weigh saving a life versus improving a life. So there's like no question that is something one has to take into account. And if someone feels very differently than us about that philosophical judgment, they should come to a different conclusion about where to give. And that's something that, you know, we're totally agree with. But regardless, the goal does end up playing a pretty big role in the ultimate ranking of charities.
So it's sort of a follow-up. In terms of, you're using the words effectiveness and impact and high quality and people moving directly, do those translate those into something a little more tangible? So like effectiveness is something about reaching your goals and impact is sort of quality adjusted life years, but can you make those a little more concrete?
Sure. So I probably have not used them fully consistently, but I think in concept, effectiveness is how well you achieve your goal. The impact, I think I usually use it to mean what is the often that takes into account cost effectiveness more, where it's like how much good are you doing, how many lives saved or improved, sorry?
Per dollar,
yes. And then what was the third one?
You said particularly perspective GiveDirectly, you were high quality, you emphasized that.
Right. So yeah, we think I guess that takes into account both the effectiveness of the organization at achieving their goal, but also transparency, communication, desire to learn from their mistakes. I guess those are a lot of main factors.
Yeah, maybe to try, I mean, to add to that a little bit. I mean, so first of all, in a blog post that we wrote when we announced our top charities, there's a summary table, and it sort of goes through each organization on these different characteristics to just say like where we rank them. So just so you know that exists if you're interested. Evidence of effectiveness, I would say, is like probability that the program actually has an effect. And largely we're relying on independent randomized controlled trials of that program. So randomized controlled trials are like the medical style of assessing whether a particular intervention has an effect, where you randomly put people in a control group, in a treatment group, and you see what happens. And the only difference between the two, presumably, is the program itself. And so often we're relying on that for evidence of effectiveness, along with the organization's own internal monitoring that we try to vet ourselves. And that spans like a very wide spectrum of quality from organization to organization. So there's really no like rule of thumb about what that looks like on any individual basis. You know, and then there's impact per dollar. That's our like best guess of like what you get for each dollar that you give. In some ways, that is like the only thing that matters, because all like a donor should care about, I guess, is how much impact they get per dollar. But because the sort of explicit modeling of that factor relies on so much guesswork, we don't want to let that one factor drive the entire analysis that we do. You certainly could try to like bake every single thing into like one model. But I don't know if anyone's like played around with these Excel models, which is what we use, and you certainly could play around with ours, it's on our website. You just get into these situations where you're like, oh, is that number a two or is that number a five? And you don't really know. And all of a sudden you've changed the cost effectiveness by a factor of 2.5. And you know, that doesn't seem like a very robust way to make a decision. And then finally with the organizational quality, I mean, one way we think about it is just like, in a sense, it's this very subjective, like how confident are you in the organization and its people? I think that is like a very concerning type of judgment for you all to be outsourcing to us, and a very difficult judgment for us to be making. What we tend to rely on are groups that can answer our questions well. It's where it seems like we're asking questions about program effectiveness. If they have thought about it before and have a good answer, we feel pretty good. Another way we think about this is, would we likely know if some problem arose? In GiveDirectly's case, they found that a year and a half ago, some of their staff in Uganda perpetrated a fraud where they stole $20,000 from the organization. That's a relatively small amount. They're moving about $25 million a year right now. So, a small portion, but nonetheless, like a meaningful one. But they found it, they told us about it, they wrote about it publicly, and that's the type of outcome that we expect from GiveDirectly, and we wouldn't necessarily expect from an organization with which we've had more trouble communicating.
Yeah. The menu or the list of your favorite charities, I think, is very impressive in the methodology is too, and that it goes toward the alleviation of suffering and promotion of health is undeniably great. I'm wondering, why are there not opportunities in other sectors, and I'm thinking here conservation of nature, historic preservation, in which there are not opportunities equally certifiably as rewarding as the ones you've picked in the alleviation of suffering in Africa and India? I can think of a few quick hits seagrass plantations or reef restorations or saving the Art Deco neighborhood in Havana, which could give you, I think, comparably satisfying confidence in telling a donor that, yeah, this is really going to work and this is going to be an effective step in these organizations that are doing it practically.
Right. So we're coming to this work with a set of values that we are trying to accomplish, and those are not values that are shared by everyone, and definitely people could disagree with them reasonably. So our values include global humanitarianism. So we believe that lives around the world have equal value, I guess that is sort of the main one to your point. We wouldn't value historical preservation as highly because we would guess that it does not have the same effect on human suffering and achievement.
Do you think your methodology might be applicable?
Conceptually, yes, but I think in practicality, I would guess that there are significantly fewer pieces of evidence to support the case for historical preservation. But I have really not looked into that at all, so that's just a total guess.
I mean, I might bet that a little, like one way we sometimes think about our work is that, one of the questions we got all the time when GiveAll was starting is how does this scale? And people said, there's so many charities out there, how can you ever look at all of them? Clearly we can't, we don't intend to. But because we make all our research public and we're trying to show what we do, we hope that others will take up the type of research we do. I mean, with historical preservation, it clearly wouldn't be exactly the same type of analysis, but the attitude of, you know, I think critical assessment of opportunities to find outstanding giving opportunities could exist across many causes. And we've actually seen one case of this happen already. There's a group called Animal Charity Evaluators. They're part of this effective altruism movement of which GiveWell is sort of a part. And you know, they are taking the GiveWell methodology, so to speak, and applying it to looking for groups that are trying to alleviate the suffering of animals in industrialized agriculture. And you know, I think for people with a certain set of values, that is potentially like an incredibly cost-effective cause to be working in. And you know, we hope that other types of initiatives like this will spring up, where people take something like the GiveWell approach and apply it to their area of interest, and then hopefully that could help more people.
Thank you very much.
The list of top charities and standout charities seems to be a little more static over the past couple of years than it had been in the past. You consider this to be a good thing because you think that you've found the best charities, or a bad thing because you're not uncovering further charities, or over both, or how do you do that?
We would definitely like to be finding great new charities that are better or comparable with our current top charities, and we continue to do that work. We, I think, didn't have enough capacity this year to do that as fully as we had hoped, and so I think that's part of the static nature. On the other hand, we have been at this for many years now, and we think that we think there's like a decent chance we've uncovered, like, I guess the best ones with the methodology that we're using, but we're constantly changing that methodology and improving it, and so I think there's definitely opportunities for us to uncover new ones, and we hope to do that in the next year.
Yeah, I guess I would say it's at least a little bit of both. I mean, I think it's possible that bed nets and deworming in particular are just such unbelievable giving opportunities that they're very difficult to beat by other interventions. You know, bed nets, it costs $5 to get a bed net to cover two people for 2 years. You know, estimating it all out at $3,000 per life saved, that's our best guess. I mean, $3,000 to save a life seems pretty like crazy as something that you could actually take money and do. And deworming is a 50-cent pill that if you give it to a child through their middle school years, 10 years later, the study shows significant increases in income. Now there's like a whole, there's a ton of problems with this evidence, and that would be a whole different conversation if people are interested. But nonetheless, it's a 50-cent pill that treats and clears a parasitic infection. And there's some evidence that this might have astounding impacts on long-term development. And so I think these are two opportunities that, I mean, I kind of am both hopeful and expecting that like 10 years from now, these types of giving opportunities won't exist anymore. Because I would just guess that like donors will have closed these gaps. I mean, I think in total there's, you know, something like on the order of $500 million of room in these interventions, you know, $500 million. So that's way more than you know, GiveWell can influence today, and even governments. I mean, governments are providing large amounts of aid, but they're not closing that final gap. And so it seems though that that's an amount that in the next 10 years you could imagine being totally closed, either through charity or through general development.
Yeah, so I mentioned that you
Yep, so we have definitely tried to look at some of the programs that you're talking about. For example, water infrastructure is a program that we've looked at in depth. We found that there's not strong evidence for the interventions that charities are running. I think the longer term potential solutions tend to be more speculative. There tends to not be the same evidence of effectiveness of those types of organizations. So there's not, as far as I'm aware, a malaria intervention that is known to have a long-term effect on a community and wiping out malaria. And that's actually been tried there. I think in the 50s or 60s, there was a large-scale malaria eradication attempt, which was ultimately not successful. So I think we're definitely open and would, you know, love to see a long-term impact of the interventions that we are looking at. And I think there is long-term impact or potential long-term impact of the interventions, just maybe not in the way, not in, say, disease eradication, but in terms of the effects on individuals. I think long-term systems change is great, but we just haven't seen the evidence that can really be achieved by donors in our position, at least.
Yeah. Kind of really, but less about long-term system change, but just about interventions that take a long time in general. Curious what you have experience in terms of, like, you know, charities such as those who are sending kids to school instead of having them do, you know, child labor, for example, which has, like, a long-term, long payoff time. Curious if you guys have looked into that, and also if there's any opportunity in influencing any organizations who are doing it now to start collecting data, so in 5 years you might have something to look at.
It's definitely more difficult to collect that type of data, and so I think systematically there's more evidence of effectiveness for shorter-term shorter-term interventions. It's easier to do the study, to get funding for the study, and so I think there's probably somewhat of a bias towards shorter-term things. The one example that we've seen of a real long-term effect is in deworming, and that is really sort of the backbone of the case for deworming. And we'd love to see more evidence for that, but for an intervention like deworming, we expect the funding gap is probably going to be closed before you can redo the study. So I guess we'd be interested in types of studies you could do that were more long-term, but haven't sort of come across a really good case for something that is very promising, such that it's worth investing the many millions of dollars that it would take in the study and the time.
In terms of where, like, GiveWell is coming from to some extent is, I mean, as you probably know, there's a lot of controversy over how well international aid really works. So there's kind of the aid critics, there's the aid supporters. And, you know, one of the questions that I think is reasonable to ask is how effective could we really be at trying to solve these, like, very thorny, hard to address problems in a societies that are extremely different from our own, are thousands of miles away. And so the attitude that the sort of the GiveWell project takes is one that says, we really don't know very much. And so what we're going to focus on is the set of opportunities that we can get the most information about possible in the charitable world. And that definitely means that we're leaving some potential high risk opportunities on the table. And that's not because we don't think they're, like, worth undertaking. It's just not what GiveWell is primarily focused on. Now, I personally think that what we have seen from the track record of those activities in developing countries over the last 50 years is, like, not very strong. So I think it's, like, a reasonable bet to make on the more measurable shorter term stuff. The Open Philanthropy Project, the work that, you know, Chloe's going to talk about in a few minutes, that those are areas that are certainly, like, not evidence based in the way that GiveWell top charities are, and is our attempt to venture more into the, let's say, like, systematic change or the higher risk, higher reward, broader impact than the direct interventions that GiveWell's top charities undertake. So I think now's a good point to just transition, because I want to I guess I want to pause and go through a few minutes of just talking about GiveWell's future research plans, and then we can take another round of questions on GiveWell before moving on to open philanthropy. So just a sort of a general organizational update at GiveWell is we've grown a lot over the past few years. So when we actually used to work in this building, in green spaces, in the co-working space downstairs, we were five people when we were working here in 2012, and now we're 31 staff members. So we've really grown substantially over the last few years. And the goal of that growth has been to both expand the capacity of GiveWell's research, so we're able to look into causes that we haven't looked into before, also expand the capacity for the Open Philanthropy Project, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a few minutes, and then finally to try and get started on work that we've really deprioritized for a long time, which is reaching out to donors and telling them about the work we do. For almost our entire history, GiveWell has focused on research and deprioritized outreach, because we felt that the most important thing for us was to identify the best giving opportunities possible. And we've been really fortunate that people have found us and spread the word, so we didn't have to focus as much on outreach. But in the past year, we've made our first directed outreach hires, who are now actively trying to get the word out more directly than we did in the past. I think one of the biggest challenges that we've had with all the growth that we've done is while we have grown from five people to 31 people, we definitely have yet to, it's not like we've increased our overall output by a factor of six. You know, we have spent a lot of time building capacity, bringing that capacity online, and I think that we're now at the point in 2016 where we're starting to turn the corner from capacity building and hiring, evaluating, training, managing, to actually having that capacity come online and produce what we hope it can. And that's certainly both across GiveWell and Open Philanthropy. And so I think that probably over the past few years, we've done, you know, maybe twice as much as we were able to do when we were five people, but certainly growing itself has been a huge priority of ours and certainly mine personally over the last couple of years. So just to sort of get more into the specifics, there's really two parts. Open philanthropy is a huge part of our future research agenda, but I want to leave that to the, you know, for what we're going to talk about in a few minutes. On the GiveWell side of things, there's really two big areas in which we hope to grow in the next year. So one area is essentially just doing more of the same type of work that we've done, but expanding it. And so that means following the groups that we currently recommend, but doing so more intensively. So maybe doing more site visits, more audits, trying to answer every question that we have as opposed to 90% of the questions that we have. I mentioned this to a couple of our top charities at the end of last year, and it kind of scared them that we had more questions that we hadn't asked them, but so be it. Another thing we'd like to do is look at more programs that are within the same framework of programs we've evaluated before, but just ones we have not gotten to yet due to lack of capacity. So we've looked, Natalie talked about deworming. This is treating these parasitic worm infections. There are other diseases in the class that's called neglected tropical diseases that we haven't evaluated, but seem as if they could potentially be similar to deworming in cost effectiveness. There are additional micronutrient programs and immunization programs that we've looked into to some extent, but have yet to really fully evaluate to the extent that we would have liked to. And then there are also areas that we looked into in our very early days and, you know, haven't revisited just due to lack of capacity. So if you go on our website, you'll see a literature review of international education programs. And we put this literature review together in the summer of 2009, and we really haven't revisited it since because we haven't been able to. But in the last 6.5 years, there's been significantly more rigorous research on the, you know, programs generally, but I would guess education programs. And I think we now have the capacity to come back to programs like that. So education is one area I'd like to come back to. Family planning, you know, providing people control over how many children they have is an area that I think will be challenging because our impression is the evidence base is not particularly strong, but it's also an area that seems potentially very impactful. And then finally, surgery organizations. So I think surgery charities are maybe some of the more salient groups to people in the US. Often they make claims of impact that are extreme. They'll say things like $50 per blindness averted. And so often what they're talking about is performing a 20-minute cataract surgery that repairs a cataract in a developing country. These are groups that we've really struggled to look into before. In particular, a question we have is around the criterion of what we call room for more funding, which is what impact marginal dollars will have. Years ago, we had this conversation with a surgery organization where they told us how they funded a surgeon in India who was, they were telling us, essentially worked around the clock. And so he like worked 18-hour days and hardly slept. And so when we asked them what additional dollars would do, I mean, they said, well, you know, it would allow us to get the word out more or build our internal capacity, but it wouldn't enable them to perform more surgeries because money wasn't the bottleneck. Surgeons who could perform the surgery were. And so, you know, that's definitely not to say that's not the last word on surgery. I mean, in some ways, it's the beginning of our investigation, but it's because we have to answer that question, and I think it will be working with smaller organizations in different areas. We expect this to be a more challenging area to look into, but it's one that we've already begun some work on, and we hope to make progress on this year. And then there's a whole other area of GiveWell work that we're excited about, and what we call this, for lack of a better term, GiveWell experimental. But the idea is supporting the development of future GiveWell top charities. And so the idea here is, you know, once what GiveWell is looking for, ideally, is a group that has a strong independent evidence base, a group that's already been operating for a while and has a long track record, and also has monitoring and evaluation data available to demonstrate that its programs are working. And so you can see how what we are looking for requires other funders to have participated along the line to put us in a position where there's a group that we can potentially evaluate and recommend. And so with this area of our work, we're really thinking about providing support to organizations at any point along that spectrum. So it could mean funding research that academics are undertaking to evaluate the evidence of a program. And we provided some funding to researchers from MIT in a program that they're now evaluating again in both India and Pakistan to see whether giving parents incentives when they bring their children to immunization camps increase, so basically that people will periodically come to a central area to get the routine childhood immunizations. And the question is whether this small incentive increases uptake of the vaccine by enough that it's worth the money that you put in as an incentive. And so there's been one trial of this program. We recommended that Good Ventures, the foundation we work closely with, provide additional funding. And so those trials are ongoing. And there's a write-up on our website about it if you're interested. But the long-term hope is that this helps build the evidence base for another priority program and potentially a recommended organization. Another chink along the line is at the point of an organization that's trying to get started. And so we provided some funding to a group called New Incentives, which provides conditional cash transfers to encourage pregnant women who are HIV positive to take the AIDS treatment drugs that prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And so they give a cash incentive at various points throughout pregnancy and then after birth. And this is both, this conditional cash transfer is both intended to directly transfer money to very poor people, but also hopefully reduce cases of HIV. This conditional cash transfers is an area that has a significant evidence base. And we felt that this organization was very transparent, was planning to collect data in the way that we hoped. And so we and another funder provided some, you know, essentially seed funding. And they're operating now in one state in Nigeria. You can read more about them on our website. And then finally, you know, we're interested in providing monitoring and evaluation support to organizations that are potentially running really great programming, but just don't have the monetary capacity or the knowledge about how to implement monitoring effectively. And so this is an area that we've got a lot of questions about over the years. You know, do you provide consulting to charities to help them undertake better monitoring? You know, this is really a little bit outside the scope of what I think we are able to do. I mean, we've talked a lot about capacity so far tonight, and I don't think we'd be able to do it. But what we have done is find another organization whose mission is to help organizations produce high-quality monitoring. This is a group called ID Insight. And we provided some funding to them to try and conduct some independent monitoring of a program that's being implemented by SCI, one of our current top charities. The reason we started with SCI is, as Natalie said, they're a group that we've had some of the least information about amongst our top charities, and so we really wanted to learn more about the effectiveness of their programming. And we also wanted to find an opportunity to work with ID Insight, where because of the funding that GiveWell donors had provided, we had a little more leverage in encouraging the charity to participate. But the goal here is that if this, we see this essentially as a pilot project, and if it goes well, then we'd be really excited about the potential of supporting ID Insight as a partner organization that could work with charities to help them collect the data or produce the monitoring that we're looking for. And so our big picture hopes with you know, the both the broadening of our work that's sort of within the same scope of what we do, but also the GiveWell experimental, is to have additional top charities in future years. I think we're largely trying to prioritize based on the groups that could be significantly better than the charities we currently have, but we're also cognizant of the fact that the gaps that we currently see for bed nets and deworming might be filled. There's always a possibility with such a small number of groups that problems arise that cause us to not recommend them anymore, or the charities themselves may run out of room for more funding with the attention donors are paying to them. And so we feel it's you know, very high priority to keep looking for and identifying new outstanding opportunities. So I want to again pause and open the floor up for questions, either on the new research or on anything about GiveWell in general. So this is the Against Malaria Foundation. They are our current number one ranked giving opportunity, and they're, like Colin said, a very small staff. So they're basically two full time people.
Yeah. So they're very small. I think they GiveWell's perspective is they might be able to benefit from some additional capacity, but it's really hard as outsiders to make that decision and to know what's best for them. So largely we trust them on them and judge them on their results. They have considered hiring additional staff and may do so in the future. They've said to us that they believe they could benefit from additional staff, and it's really a matter of finding a really good fit for such a small organization.
Yeah, I mean, we do see it. Like, I agree with what Natalie said. I mean, we also see a difference between AMF, say, and GiveDirectly. I mean, I think AMF is a small organization that at its current size is successfully able to take donor money and turn it into like bed nets in the field. But I think that's like more or less the extent of what they can do. And then GiveDirectly is an organization that is able to do that for their program, take money and get it to very poor people, but is also trying to build up a large organization that could potentially have even broader impacts. And so some of the types of things GiveDirectly is trying to do, Natalie mentioned this before, but encourage government aid programs, which I think are notoriously poorly studied, many people think ineffective, to at least assess whether their programs are as effective or more effective than the cash they're spending on them. They also, one of the outgrowths of GiveDirectly has been this for-profit company that they launched a year and a half ago called Segovia, where they're, because of what they saw working with governments, they are now trying to develop, the people who started GiveDirectly independently are starting this company that's trying to sell software to developing country governments that will reduce leakage, meaning money that gets sucked out of the system by the people in the system. to increase the amount of money that's going there. And so this is the type of sort of, so this is called Segovia, the name of the company. And you know, they're trying to, this is the type of sort of upside you could imagine from a Give Directly that doesn't really seem that likely with AMF given how they're operating. Yeah, sure. So what you're talking about is something that is known as worm wars. It was one of the most exciting things to happen in global health in the last few years. And so basically, the big picture with deworming is that, I think the sort of particular hubbub was around researchers who reanalyzed the data for one of the key studies for deworming, and it reduced the impacts of the studies relative to what had previously been there. And there was a whole brouhaha because the researchers had previously picked like one approach to analyzing the data, and the follow-up picked another approach, and a lot of people thought that the follow-up approach was potentially worse than the initial approach. Suffice to say, I think that what really matters about deworming and what's important to know is that, you know, we see deworming as a high expected value program, not a high likelihood of impact program. So I think that, like, what I mean by that is the consensus among, I think if you ask most GiveWell staff members, or I'll tell you my view, you know, but the sort of consensus is that it is more likely than not that deworming programs do not have a significant effect. So when I give to SCI, which is one of our deworming charities, my expectation is that we're treating a worm, it's doing something that's like kind of good, but the effect is not very large. But there is some chance, based on some limited evidence, that the program is having a very, very large effect. And it's so cheap that we think this program is one of the best giving opportunities. And so a lot of the discussion around worm wars focused on the fact that the evidence is, you know, for lack of a better word, like pretty sketchy. It's just very limited. But, you know, this is a fact that we have always accepted. If you look at our cost effectiveness model, which is just a big Excel file on our website, the sort of aggregate discount that GiveWell staff apply to the headline effects in the biggest trials is like reducing the effect by a factor of 98%. So when we tell you that it's like very effective, we are assuming that it is far less effective than what was found in the trial. If you believe the trial effects, I mean, you'd end up with something that was like 50 times or 100, 400 times as cost effective as bed nets. So I guess I'm going into this at some length because I think it's like one of the things we discussed internally this year is we think this is probably one of the things that donors following our research don't know about our view, which is that if what you're looking for is high certainty, I think Give Directly is by far the best thing you can give to. And because it is less cost effective, but I think you are almost certainly significantly helping someone. And then, you know, bed nets are pretty cost effective. Very cost effective, but you know, there still are ways that bed net programs can go wrong. I think the single biggest concern we have right now is around insecticide resistance. And what that means is that nets are treated with insecticide and they function both as a physical barrier to prevent mosquitoes from biting people, but they also are a control mechanism where they kill mosquitoes as they land on the nets. And so this part of the impact may be diminishing. And the global malaria community is very worried about insecticide resistance. We've written a lot about it on our website, and we've reduced our like estimated cost effectiveness by a factor because of the evidence of insecticide resistance, but it's still not enough to sort of fully change our mind, but it's definitely a way in which bed nets could go wrong. And then finally, there's deworming, which I think is more likely than not having a very big impact, but is extremely cheap and maybe having a very large impact, and that makes it a pretty good giving opportunity.
I was walking out in the Bowery just a little north of here on Sunday, and I passed a store that just sold avocados, and my friend and I were wondering how they can make a go of that. It seems like it's much more efficient since they have the space already rented to offer a wider range of products. Do you have the capacity, or is it something you're considering doing, that you can get the deworming organization to work directly with the malarial organization, or find an organization that does both? Because then you put one person in the field and they accomplish twice as, potentially up to twice as much. Or if there's a third factor, three times as much.
Yeah, so it's a good question. I mean, I think this is something that often ends up seeming better, like, in theory than in practice. As an example with bed net programs, something like 3/4 of the costs are the bed net itself. And so the commodity is already like a pretty big part of the cost structure of the program. And so I don't think the savings are not quite as large as, you know, we might have thought. And then I think another issue is that coordinating the two multiple different programs often have different timelines for distribution. Bed nets are trying to be distributed on now like every 3 years in many places. And something like deworming is happening either every 6 months or every year. They're often targeting different groups of people. And so my guess is that for very different interventions, the efficiency gained is not like as big a deal as we might think. There certainly are attempts in the neglected tropical disease community where the diseases often affect the same populations. The treatment given is very similar. It's a pill given every 6 months or every year. And the target group, like the population is the same, to try and do what's called integrated neglected tropical disease control. And I think that's one of the possible ways. It's a possible type of organization I could imagine us recommending in the future, where they just are like adding on an additional pill or two to an existing distribution.
Or how about give directly, setting up entrepreneurs to offer a whole basket of beneficial things. So you create a business for somebody, reduce the amount of money that the donors have to give, because their GiveWell money is going to, so the people can then purchase in their community the bed nets, and you don't have to buy the bed nets. You're setting up businesses and starting infrastructure for an economy there.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea, and I think GiveDirectly has at least thought about that. I'm not sure if they've actually started experimenting with providing at least information to recipients on ways, beneficial ways that they could use their transfers. I do think it would create, I don't think an organization that's competency is in giving out cash transfers would necessarily be effective at setting up local businesses, and that would likely increase their costs significantly. So I think there's potential weaknesses in the plan, but just to add on what Ellie was saying a little, like even within neglected tropical diseases, they use different distribution strategies through schools versus through communities. They also, if you give too many of the pills at once, they can have side effects. So even within fairly similar programs, there can be downsides to doing them together. And in practicality, I think the main thing they've run into is one program being ready to go, all the pills in the country, and some bottleneck happening with the other pill where it didn't quite get into place. And so everything getting delayed because one piece of the program. So the more you add complexity, I think there are real downsides. But I do think that the information given to GiveDirectly recipients could be really beneficial to them, and I'm excited to see that research when it becomes available.
Thank you.
Yep.
I'm wondering if you think that there's any worry about the incentive. Like, you mentioned with Anna, but I find interesting that we're two full-time staff members. And I wonder if you think that by constantly including them on the top charities, you're incentivizing them to change, to do the kind of stuff that GiveDirectly is doing. And maybe you're saying, like, well, they're going to constantly know that they're going to be getting this large source of funding, so we don't have to make these sort of internal organizational changes. But on the other hand, maybe that's a strength because they can focus on the things that you really care about, which is, you know, data analysis and monitoring. So I don't know if you see that as like a strength or a weakness.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely talked about the fact that by giving AMF significant support, we are enabling them to not go out and fundraise for themselves, as an example. So like we're excited about the fact that GiveDirectly is trying to build out a fundraising operation to raise money from donors who would not have otherwise given to GiveWell and its top charities. And it is definitely a side effect of our support of AMF that they are much less likely to do that than they would be if we weren't supporting them. You know, our general attitude is GiveWell is looking for the best giving opportunities that we can find. We will tell the groups what we think about them and where we think they can improve. But then, you know, with that in mind, support them to keep doing more of what they're doing rather than, you know, really trying to take a heavy hand and force them to go down a path that seems better to us.
One thing we did do this year is to start explicitly putting weight on capacity building and telling organizations that if you can use funding to expand in such a way that you change your trajectory as an organization, we think that's really high value, and we want to make sure that that funding gap is filled. So that resulted in us providing additional funding to GiveDirectly, even though we thought they were a less cost-effective opportunity. And so it's sort of a way that we support that, perhaps not exactly incentivizing, but and something we only started this year. So we'll see how that might change things for organizations.
Do you have a question all the way in the back?
We have not looked back at Village Reach recently. I think it could be an interesting project, but probably not competitive with the other things we want to do. Vaccination in general, I think, is a really highly cost-effective program, and if there were specific opportunities for us to fund more vaccination, we would be very excited about that. The opportunities that we have looked into, the ones that we believe might have room for more funding, we've generally found that they don't have room for more funding, or the organization, there's some issue with working with the organization. For example, we have looked into maternal and neonatal tetanus, working with UNICEF, and we have had to put that investigation on hold because they don't have the capacity right now to work with us. And I think Village Reach in specific, just to go back to that, they have moved away from the specific program that we saw strong evidence for, and so they're doing a lot of different activities now, but it's not the same, there's not the same evidence of effectiveness for what they're doing currently.
Though, I mean, personally pretty interested in, like, going back to Village Reach and just seeing what's happening. Like, we spent a lot of time with them over the course of a couple of years, and you know, it has not seemed as if, like, trying to understand where they're currently at is, like, the best use of our time, given the capacity constraints, but it's definitely something that I could imagine us getting to in the next year or two, now that we have more people at GiveWell. You know, I think we really have historically, like, learned a lot from going back to things that we thought in the past and just seeing how they turned out a few years later, and so it seems you know, plausible that we'd learn something from that. We also are, like, thinking about re-engaging with PSI. PSI was actually, like, our first top-rated charity. And, you know, they're kind of an interesting case because they're, like, a huge organization, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and they run, like, many programs worldwide. And so I think the challenge for us there is going to be finding a program that has significant evidence where we really feel like if we were to direct funding to it, more of that program would happen, which is not always the case because many organizations have enough unrestricted funding that no matter what funding you provide, they can reallocate internally. But, you know, PSI is another organization that our first top charity that we may end up coming back to this year. Okay, Tom, last question, and then we'll take a quick break.
So, given the potential new breadth of research that you guys are doing, what do you envision for how that research is going to be? It's still going to be a relatively small number of top charities at the end of the year, like we're currently examining, and just a much larger set of in-depth research that's not necessarily prioritized for the general economy. Will there be other sort of rankings or efforts to raise the profile on some of that too?
I think it will probably be very similar to what you've seen. I mean, I think a possible outcome of looking into education, family planning, and surgery, which, to be clear, like, I would not guess we will finish all three of those next year. Like, I'm hopeful we'll finish, like, one additional thing like that. But I think like the possible outcome is just like one long, like three long research pages that talk about all the questions we have and the charities we looked at and the fact that we couldn't answer questions, get some questions answered, and a few charity reviews that describe our process and the questions we asked and the information we got, but ultimately end in a sort of unsatisfying way where we don't have compelling answers. You know, and if you go on our website now, you'll find a lot of that that goes beyond the four top charities we have. It's just the sort of hidden in the guts of the website, and it's all the work that stands behind the four top charities. You know, I definitely think there's a point in GiveWell's future that we will actually get better at presenting our material, like the interesting research we've done, to the outside world in a way that doesn't require people reading the equivalent of like a 50-page research report to know what we think. You know, we see this as, you know, one of our most important outreach priorities, but also probably one of the hardest to undertake effectively, because, you know, getting the right, pulling the most important pieces out of a research project and presenting it in a way that we're comfortable, frankly, given our brand that is both trying to present what we know, but also be open about our uncertainty, has been a challenge for us. But we call this project sort of the medium level depth content for GiveWell work. And you know, I hope that we get there, but I'm not optimistic that it's happening in the next 12 months. All right, so let's use this as an opportunity to take a few minute break. You know, feel free to grab more pizza if you want, and grab some more drinks, and then we'll like reconvene in a few minutes.